A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas, the TLS arts editor, and I'm joined by Alex Clark, friend of the podcast and now co-host of the podcast. Hello, Alex. How are you doing?
Hello, Lucy. I'm doing very well. I'm in my new hot seat.
Yeah, exactly. I hope it's not literally a hot seat.
No, it's flipping freezing, actually. The beginning of so-called spring up here in the hills. It's windy and cold, and what we need to do is warm our cockles with some book chat.
And we'll give you a warm welcome. How's that, Alex?
Very good, thank you.
Yeah, nice segue. I was thinking about it. So you don't actually work in the offices of the TLS, not that anybody has very much for the past 2 years, but you know what I mean. But you've been writing for us for, am I allowed to say?
Oh,
how
do.
Long? 20 years?
I would say it. I'd actually say that's nice of you, but it's probably closer to 30.
Is it really?
Yes, I think it is. The TLS was the first place I ever had a book review published.
Oh, wonderful. And look where you are now, on top of the world.
Look where I am now. I have been writing away for you for various bits of the paper over the years. I'm not obviously allowed into the nerve center. I'm not allowed into the hallowed halls, but you do allow me, by the magic of remote podcasting, to join you.
Yeah, delighted. So what have you been reading recently? That is there anything we should take note of, or you know, run towards or avoid, do you think?
Well, funnily enough, of course, it's, you know, we're coming into spring, aren't we? And huge titles coming up. And for me, the festival season also. So I have all the books that I'm going to be reading in order to talk to their writers at spring festivals, hither, thither and yon. And so I've just read the second novel by the Booker Prize winner, Douglas Stewart. It's his sort of sequel to Shaggy Bane, although it's a different set of characters, same sort of setting, a little bit later in the post-Thatcherite era. So I've been reading that, and I'm just about to throw myself into the new novel by Rose Tremaine. So yes, I've got a teetering stack. And actually, I've been reading an awful lot of European novels in translation, because with another TLS notable, Toby Lichtig, we are judging a prize of European literature in translation. So we've been busy honing our skills for the EBRD prize, of which more anon, I'm sure.
Yeah, we would love to hear about that. What's the most recent one you read then in translation?
Well, I have been reading, and I mean, you know, you can imagine that it becomes ever more sort of on point. We've been reading The Orphanage by Serhiy Khachan, Ukrainian writer. And so that has had a cut, and it's set in the sort of recent Ukrainian past, which of course has come to have a tremendous additional relevance. And also, not to put too fine a point on it, for those who are not particularly steeped in Ukrainian society and politics and history, it has been unbelievably illuminating. So yes, that's one of the last books I read for that prize. We have a long list. We will soon have a short list. And perhaps we'll ask Toby to join us and chat about it at some point in the future.
Yeah, that would be great. But before we get to that, I need to tell everyone what is coming up on this week's show. Who was Jane Austen before she was Jane Austen? Or Life Before Bonnets? We'll be joined by E.J. Cleary to discuss a new edition of The Watsons and Sanditon and a collection of Austen's other unpublished writing. And another question, is Kes still ingrained in the psyche of the North? And if so, why?
But first, Jane Austen was writing from when she was 11 years old, cooking up madcap plots and comic capers for her family's entertainment. So do early works such as Love and Friendship and Lady Susan show us a freer and more exuberant writer than we might expect? And if so, what happened to her? And what of the stories that Austen left unfinished? A new edition of The Watsons and Sanditon, edited by Catherine Sutherland, and Freya Johnston's Jane Austen Early and Late may shed new light on a writer we all think we know. Emma Cleary has reviewed them both and joins us now. Emma, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
I was really taken just diving into your piece right at the beginning. You basically issue a kind of warning. It starts with a really sort of cautionary tale. You say, if we go into these less well-known Austen works, we will find that they're basically unknowable and that we will lose our soulmate and our solace. And I was really struck by that idea of these two Austens, the Austen from the six novels that we're most familiar with and this other Austen from the early and late work. And you see them as very different writers, I took from that. Is that right?
Well, I was inhabiting a certain mindset about the unpublished writers to begin with in the review, partly to grab the reader and just sort of, I suppose, put across the idea that the manuscript writings have been considered to be a problem, even by some of their earliest supporters of Jane Austen's work, including her own family. And so these manuscript works were basically unknown until around 1870 to the general public. And at that point, one of her nephews and two of her nieces got together to discuss what they might make public at that point. So the nephew, James Austen Leigh, had written a short memoir of the life of his aunt. And this was really the first time that readers of Jane Austen got to know about her as a person. There'd just been very brief indications previously. Her work, of course, was all originally published anonymously. And so there was all this behind the scenes material, and they were very concerned about establishing her reputation, reinforcing it with a very uplifting tale of almost the ideal woman, you know, a perfect sort of decorous, pious writer, who was extremely gifted, who never made a false step when it came to composing her literary works, a genius. And they were worried that these early works and the later unfinished manuscripts would undermine the impression that they were trying to give. And so initially, very little was included. I think maybe there was one or two short pieces from her juvenile writings. And then with a bit of pressure from some of the readers, a bit more was revealed in the second edition of the memoirs. But with great reluctance and quite a lot of tinkering to smooth over the rough edges. And basically it was left at that until the 20th century. Now, at that point, R.W. Chapman, who was a don at Oxford University, became the new sort of professional guardian of the flame, and began producing scholarly editions of the published novels. He began, I think it was in the 1930s, probably began work even earlier than that. But it wasn't until 1954 that he actually got round to publishing the manuscript works. And when he did, he was really quite quite iffy about them. You know, he actually said in his preface, "I'm not really sure whether it's worth making these works public." So all along, for people who were trying to establish Jane Austen as one of the literary greats, as a canonical writer, these texts have posed a problem. So I think I started my review from the premise that, yes, these are problem works, and they are going to introduce you to a very different writer.
It seems like a very old-fashioned idea. It's almost the romantic idea, isn't it? Of the there's never any revision, or there's never any edits. There's no early work that works up to it. Everything just pours out perfectly formed, and then that's the work, and it's a perfect tool. But surely that's people don't. I don't know whether people thought then that that's what happened, but that's not what happened with the Romantics or anyone else, of course. Really hard work. And I would have thought by the 20th century, people would realise that people edited and rewrote and changed things.
Yes, I mean, you would have thought. I mean, there's certainly been the study of manuscripts from Jane Austen's period from an early stage. People like Wordsworth and Coleridge left reams of Shelley, of manuscript versions of their works. And they've been pored over by scholars for a very long time. But maybe that's a difference between female authored and male authored literary works. I think people were not so interested in the genesis of her ideas. They bought into the idea that she was an untutored genius who was naturally gifted, barely had to cross anything out. This was very much the gist of the very first biographical outline of her from the introduction of her posthumous works, Persuasion and Northanger Abbey. By her brother Henry, who acted as her literary agent.
I wonder if you could say a bit about this juvenilia, which, you know, as I was mentioning in the introduction, she wrote her for family and friends, but she must have taken it seriously to some extent, because she sort of collected this all together in leather bound notebooks, didn't she? But what was she? I wonder what was she doing in those works like Love and Friendship and Lady Susan that we would recognise as something that she followed through into her later work.
Yes, well, I suppose yes, we're getting into the continuity idea here. I mean, what are these works and where do they come from? Well, there are about 27 items. Most of them very short, some only a page long or even less than a page. In these three manuscript notebooks. And yes, she clearly did feel that they were worth safeguarding. I think it's Margaret Ann Doody in her introduction to the Juvenilia mentions that a contemporary of Austen's, Frances Burney, who was much more famous in the day, she actually made a ceremonial bonfire of her Juvenilia. So the fact that Austen didn't is intriguing, and it's testimony to, I suppose, the culture of the Jane Austen family, the literary culture of this family, that. It's very much these works are a gateway into her formation within this very close-knit family circle, very highly literate, very clever, very witty, a whole family of authors, really. So there's 27 items, mostly they're short fictions. There's a couple of very short play scripts, and there's the start of a novel, Catherine or the Bower, and Love and Friendship. Which is a complete work in letter form. And then a little bit later on, you get Lady Susan, which is a novella probably composed in the 1790s, a little bit later than the Juvenilia, and then fair copied at a later stage before Jane Austen actually started her publishing career in 1811. In the family circle, there was a tremendous amount of writing of different kinds, charades, riddles, comic poems. They were very into wordplay and nonsense. And to some extent, the work in that is preserved in these manuscripts, the Juvenilia, could be seen as collaborative. Well, it is in the case of the History of England, this spoof textbook history to which her sister Cassandra contributed the illustrations. And there's an idea that the portraits of the monarchs in this manuscript are based on family members. So there's sort of layers of meaning there that we can't quite get into. And some of them, I mean, people have tried to decode them to some extent. But
you mentioned that even, you know, even a couple of generation or so later, the younger members of the family, you know, the ones who sort of put themselves forward as the potentially, you know, the keepers of the plane, they missed some of those codes and those clues as well, didn't they?
Yes, well, they do seem, they can't explain, I think, the leap from the Jane Austen of the early writings or the unfinished writings and the six perfect novels that were actually published and completed. So they were sort of baffled by it. I mean, in some cases, I think they were in on the joke, but there was a kind of alchemy here, it seems, in her creativity, which creates a sort of gulf of understanding. And I think critics then have really been puzzling over this and become more and more interested in this apparent gap in her processes, and trying to figure out how you do get from this rough work, the behind the scenes work, to her public writings.
One of the things that you sort of mentioned that does seem to be a sort of link is that she's very interested in sending up, satirizing, almost pastiching perhaps, writers that, you know, I don't know, she didn't think much of what she enjoyed, but she wanted to pick holes in what the sentimental novels, I suppose.
Absolutely, yes.
That was right there in the early work, but we can see that later in her work, can't we?
We can, absolutely. And Northanger Abbey is a wonderful case in point. That was the first of the novels that she nearly got it published at the beginning of her career, and then it actually got a revised version published posthumously. But yes, I mean, there you can absolutely see a continuity. And so there is this idea, I think, among the early commentators on the manuscripts, like Brian Southam, that she's engaged in an apprenticeship. So she's processing the fashions, the literary fashions of her day, in a satirical form, and by burlesquing them, kind of learning lessons from them and learning how to transcend them to some extent, learning what she doesn't want to do, and doing it with this in these extraordinarily clever and witty ways. So a lovely example of that is Love and Friendship, and I think that would be a very good entry point for anyone who hasn't read the manuscripts. Have a go with Love and Friendship. So here we have probably the masterpiece of the teenage writings. It's this wonderful spoof on sentimental fiction in letter form that was tremendously popular in the 1770s and 80s. I think Goethe's The Sorrows of Young Werther is referenced in it. And what you've got throughout this is an absolutely hilarious clash between the high-flown rhetoric of feeling among the main characters and their incredibly amoral behavior, especially when it comes to money. So the main couples, there are two couples, they rebel against their parents, they go on the road, they're leeching off sympathetic dupes. And all of this is being related through the voice of Laura telling her tragic story, the tragic story of her youth to the daughter, someone from the next generation, daughter of a childhood friend. She and her mates they never steal money, they gracefully purloin it. with great self-righteousness. And the main moral of the tale seems to be, and this is one of her sterling lines from the Juvenilia, I mean, written when she was about, I think in this case, 15, run mad as often as you choose, but do not faint.
She was sort of reacting, I suppose, to these overly moralistic sort of stories. The novel is something that improved a person that you might see in Samuel Richardson or someone. Is that a fair way to understand her?
Yes, that's right. And I think that's curious, isn't it? Because she is often seen as being quite a didactic writer. There's a sort of thread of seriousness throughout her work. She's dealing with serious topics, and there's all sorts of minute and sort of carefully graded. She's not obvious with her moralism, but minute moral evaluations going on throughout. And people often say, you know, her characters are so rounded, they're so complex. They're not cardboard cutouts, illustrations of good and evil. But none of that in the Juvenilia. Here we have really cartoon characters for the most part that make often no sense at all. And yet they're always very, they often use the language of morality. I mean, there's a brilliant opening to Henry and Eliza, which was written at the age of 13. Sir George and Lady Harcourt were superintending the labours of their haymakers, rewarding the industry of some by smiles of approbation and punishing the idleness of others by a cudgel. So this is just one instance of the manic kind of violence and extremity of a lot of these works. Elsewhere and further along in Eliza and Henry and Eliza, you've got the heroine Eliza. She's escaped from a dungeon where she's been imprisoned with her children, her infant children, by a mortal enemy. She began to find herself rather hungry and had reason to think by their biting off two of her fingers that her children were much in the same situation. Casual cannibalism there.
And it is true to say we don't get very many cudgels and sort of dismembered fingers, do we, later on in Jane Austen, I wouldn't say.
None at all. And you've got nobody dying on scene at all, famously. Yes, it just shows the restraint she's using, given that her imagination did, when she was a teenager, run wild, and she allowed it to. And so that's part of that's led to a different spin on the discontinuity idea, perhaps most influentially put forward by Margaret Ann Doody in an earlier edition from OUP of the Juvenilia. What she's showing in some of these early works is a kind of feminist rage. I mean, a rage against inequalities of various kinds, particularly the situation of impoverished young women. You can imagine that with her own future rather uncertain and never very secure indeed during her lifetime financially, this was something that was very close to home. So the idea that Doody had was that the expression of this anger had to be suppressed when you enter into print culture. It wasn't acceptable to the reading public, but you can let rip when it comes to the private writing. Here she found a much more sort of authentic Austenian voice, sometimes carried over. I mean, there are some spiky moments in the published writings, and you can trace them back to really the dominant tone of the early writings, and also you could say the very late unfinished work, Sanditon.
It seems also as though the thing that people object to is high spirits. That was high spirits in all sorts of ways, and some of it, I mean, it may well have been rage as well, and some of it is high spirits and kind of being silly, which for a teenage writer is absolutely fine, isn't it? I mean, that's easy for me to say now, but I guess in the 18th century it wasn't.
Yes, well, I think, again, it's very interesting to look to Northanger Abbey, perhaps, as the finished work that's perhaps closest to the juvenile in some ways. There you've got a very high-spirited heroine, who's not a heroine, we're told at the beginning, not at all your cookie-cutter heroine. But from a certain age, she has to go into training as a heroine in order to take her place in society. So there's a very interesting development being traced there, and you could consider it a kind of allegory of her own transitions as a writer, the transitions she had to make, the compromises she had to make in order to get published. But there's no doubt that she develops other skills with maturity. I don't want to diss the finished six.
This idea, as you say, Margaret Ann Doody was one of the sort of proponents of it, that she had to, I mean, it sounds almost as if the idea is she has to kind of smooth off her rough edges to be palatable for a wider audience. In terms of the kind of way that books were published at the time and the reading public, I mean, does that ring true for you?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, particularly with women's writing. I mean, if you look back at the male tradition of Henry Fielding or Tobias Smollett, there's a lot more of the knockabout, you know, quite raw comedy. And actually, there is quite a lot in Frances Burney as well. If you look at Evelina or Cecilia, there's some broad comedy there too, and violent moments.
Sort of part of the picaresque, I suppose.
Yes.
And then this comes more into the drawing room in a way.
But I think in the case of Burney, she has to balance it with much more emphatic didacticism. And you might say that Jane Austen found a kind of more effective or a more subtle balance when it came to her published works.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I think of Austen's published works as full of kind of human weakness and occasional malice and malpractice and sadness too. I mean, they're not really very gentle books in lots of ways, are they?
I think that's increasingly recognised, yes. I mean, of course, that idea just does go back a little way as well. There's the critic Harding with his idea of Jane Austen's works as regulated hatred, I think. of her society. And I think that perhaps people are much more attentive today to the elements of protest and critique in her writings. And there's no doubt, I mean, that side of Austen never was left behind. It's certainly there in the Sanditon working draft as well. You've got absolutely, you know, manic characters who just take over the plot. The Parker siblings, one of them, this crazed enthusiast for entrepreneurship, creating this seaside resort out of nothing, out of a fishing village, absolutely determined to succeed, but you can tell from the outset bound to failure. And then his siblings were trying to help him, but three of them are hypochondriacs themselves, and come trying to lure others to the seaside village. So you've got absolutely none of the sort of standard, we haven't really talked about this yet, but the standard sort of the romance plot that Jane Austen is associated with. So you could say that this was her natural mode, that she never really left off. And that when left to herself, this is what she chose to do. This is how she occupied herself in some of her final months during her last illness.
And Sanditon is a novel that she set aside, isn't it? Or was it cut short because she died?
She set it aside when she became too ill, really, even to sit up in bed with a pen. So, yes, I think it ended somewhere in the 13th chapter. Maybe it was I think it was about 5 or 6 months before she died. I think it was in March 1817. I think there are some hints about how it might have ended, but so slight that really nobody knows. And so it's been a constant challenge to descendants and now, of course, to Andrew Davies to come up with an answer as to how it might have gone.
Well, then again, something that we haven't really talked about yet is just this, the whole world of Jane Austen that exists beyond the books and in on the TV screens over and over and over again. And of course, you know, in things that are nothing to do with Jane Austen, you know, directly. I mean, I guess you could say that Bridgerton and you know, TV programmes like that come out of the world of Jane Austen, the world that we began to sort of appreciate. Do you ever see anything like that ending? It doesn't show any signs of slowing down, does it?
It's true. Yes, it's quite remarkable. The adaptations keep on coming. I think I, like quite a lot of scholars of women's writing in the long 18th century, wish that filmmakers and TV adapters would look beyond Jane Austen sometimes. There's a host of wonderful writers like Maria Edgeworth and Frances Burney, who I've mentioned, who deserve a bit of a look in. There are some great stories there. But yes, it certainly does seem to be self-driving. I mean, it's just... I suppose new generations rediscover Jane Austen. There has to be adaptations for each new generation. And of course, as you say, there's a now a kind of Austen mythography and a kind of Austen industry beyond the works themselves. So you get life skills being extracted from them, guides to dating. There doesn't seem to be an end to it. The Austen name is magic.
Is it, maybe it's what the modern, I understand, is called in the modern world, the Austenverse. That's probably what you'd call it, isn't it?
The Austenverse, yes. And I mean, there's every reason for people to keep on reading Jane Austen. I mentioned her being a soulmate and a solace. Many fans, of course, read the novels again and again, almost like therapy.
Yes.
They really are the sort of, you know, there's something about them, the sort of balanced cadence of the sentences that seem to promote well-being. I think there's even been a scientific study demonstrating that reading Austen is good for you, scientifically.
Well, I feel sort of guilty as charged on one of those things, on, you know, the idea of going back to them and the soulmate and the solace. And I think it's actually something to do with the fact that you do feel that she forgives frailty, and as much she is didactic, but she has a sort of understanding of human frailty. But I must say, I now feel a bit guilty that I haven't given Maria Edgeworthy or Fanny Burney enough of a chance. And I think I should probably try to cast my net a little bit wider.
I'm sure you'll enjoy them.
Try and step beyond the Austenverse, maybe.
Yes, exactly.
Emma, how will these two books that you'd reviewed, how do you think they will deepen and help our understanding of Austen?
Oh, certainly, yes. I mean, I think I've mentioned in the review that Catherine Sutherland has been extremely important in making the texts of the manuscript writings available online. They're freely available there, so you can actually study them in in detail, and there are transcripts there. Now she's brought some of the wealth of knowledge that she's built up through preparing those texts, and also through this monograph that she published previously, Jane Austen's Textual Lives, to a new edition of the later manuscript writings. And indeed, Freya Johnston and Catherine Sutherland previously published together the teenage writings, as they call them, as a World's Classics paperback. So there's no excuse now. They're readily available, the early texts, both online and in paperback in this lovely edition. And the Frey Johnston work, as I say, yes, I think it's interesting as a contribution to the idea that there isn't a sharp divide between unpublished and published Austen, that there are all sorts of interesting perspectives that can be explored. And also, I suppose, questioning within the texts themselves of what it is to be early or late. Sometimes I think she suggests that there's a sort of maturity in some of the early writings that precedes the later ones and so in some ways exceeds them. And she looks at a number of other writers from the period who either thought chronologically about the development of their literary styles or else challenged this idea. And she looks also at different versions. I really liked, there was a nice section where she challenges Brian Southam's ideas that the early writings are simple transcripts. She brings a laser focus to crossings out and substitutions in what's just seen like fair hand copies. There's so much that can be deduced from even tiny details like this. And again, in the Sutherland edition, you can look at all the stages that a work like The Watsons and Sanditon went through and wonder about why she recrafted some sentences again and again, while others really did seem to flow uncorrected from her pen.
I have to say, these aren't old books that I've read with the same attention as I have the sort of main canonical works, but honestly, Emma, you've made me determined to remedy that situation. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us about Jane Austen before she was Jane Austen today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
On the show, we go from Northanger Abbey to the north of England, and I think because I'm a newbie here, they're going to let me get away with that segue. And we find two memoirs of growing up in Sheffield and Rochdale. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hay Festival is back in person, 26th of May to the 5th of June, and the programme is out now at hayfestival.org/Wales. It's set to be a return to remember with more than 500 speakers and performers due to take part. As well as launching the best new books, this year's event will feature a vibrant schedule of music and comedy, debates and performances for all ages. Guests will include, I'm going to take a deep breath here, there's a lot of guests and this is not all of them, an all-star Letters live cast led by Benedict Cumberbatch, alongside speakers such as Stephen Fry, Nicola Sturgeon, Damon Galgut, Bernardine Evaristo, Cressida Cowell, Elif Shafak, Devri Sridhar, Gillian Clark, Lemon Sissi, Kate Rusby, Rose Tremaine, Minnie Driver, Monica Ali, Damian Lewis, Jimmy Page, Corinne Bailey-Ray, David Harewood, David Olusoga, Ian Ranking, Inua Ellams, Jacqueline Wilson, Jarvis Cocker, PJ Harvey, and many more. And I think, Alex, you're going to be there, aren't you? Who are you going to talk to?
Well, I am going to be there. I'm very excited because I am going to, all being well, interview Minnie Driver, star of many of my favourite films.
Yeah.
But also, you're probably going back a little bit to earlier in her career. Remember that she was in the film adaptation of Mae Binchy's Circle of Friends. And
yes.
Circle of Friends was set in a tiny Irish village. That village is in fact not a few miles from where I'm sitting right now. It's very near where I live. And there is, of course, a cafe called Circle of Friends. So I'm going to see how much she remembers about the locale. And we're going to be talking about her memoir and her entire career. So I'm very excited about that.
Brilliant. You can't get her to your village and get a picture of you and Minnie Driver in the Circle of Friends cafe.
Well, Lucy, here's the thing. I do pride myself on creating a good rapport with people when I'm interviewing. So I hope that when we're on stage, I may elicit such a promise from her to return to a scene of her kind of youthful, brilliant performance, and indeed come to the Circle of Friends cafe for what we in Ireland call a toasted special, which is a delicious toasted sandwich.
Brilliant. Well, that will be no doubt one of the highlights of Hay, and you can discover the programme and the tickets at hayfestival.org/Wales. Back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Now, you may remember we talked about the idea of the North last week, the Arctic North, really. So this week we're reducing the scale a bit and talking about the North of England, as we have a review of two memoirs of growing up there in Sheffield and Rochdale, to be precise. Catherine Taylor, who is the author of a forthcoming memoir of Sheffield herself, has written us a lovely piece, and we're delighted that she's here to talk about it today. Catherine, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Lucy.
So the first book you talk about is My Own Worst Enemy, Scenes from a Childhood by Robert Edrick, who I think is better known as a novelist, isn't he? Can you set the scene for us? Where and when is it?
Sure. Robert Edrick, it's actually a pseudonym, but I don't think that's necessarily important in this instance. Robert Edrick grew up in Sheffield, post-war Sheffield. So really, we're talking about the 1950s and 60s. He left Sheffield in 1974 to go to university in Hull. And he's talking about his very working class childhood. His first 6 years were spent outside Sheffield in a village near Ecclesfield. But he talks about the encroachment of the city on the countryside and how more and more those villages were drawn into massive estates. He grows up in an area of Sheffield called Firth Park, in a street, a two up, two down, with an outside toilet, with a very domineering father and quite a subservient mother and a huge extended family, which he talks about in various brief chapters. It's a very compressed book. It's very claustrophobic. You very much get that sense of a house, a family, and a life which is potentially has all these fascinating elements in it, but actually is quite limited. Even when he goes to grammar school and he becomes, I suppose, quite alienated education-wise from his family, but also the fact that he's past the 11 plus, he's gone out of that orbit, but he's still beholden to this extraordinary bully of a father who is described almost magisterially in the book, his vanities, his toupee, which is a kind of touchstone throughout the book. His excessive gold jewellery, his cars, which are always old models, never really work properly, and the way that he blights, I suppose, the life of this particular son.
Yeah, there's a brilliant detail that you talk about his father. I mean, it's full of characters, you say, but it is his father who stands out, isn't it? The thing about him, when it's sunny and he's got his shirt open and a big necklace, is that right? And the hairs on his chest get stuck in the necklace and he spends his whole time pulling them out.
He's very vain. And he has this, it's almost kind of, I wouldn't call it homoerotic, this memorising, but there is this sense of fascination that that you feel that Edric has with this figure. So he's got all those accoutrements of, you know, what we think of as the kind of 70s, you know, the big jewellery.
The big chain, yeah.
The big chains and the cufflinks and the kind of flash suits. And that's his kind of outward exterior, I suppose. He's a different person at home, of course, once he takes his toupee off, which is ruinously expensive for the family, who are always in debt. And he buys this item on hire purchase. And when he's not wearing it, it kind of luxuriates like a sort of succubus on a wig stand in the corner of one of the rooms.
Blimey.
There's something so kind of, I don't know, sort of pathetic, I suppose, about the idea of a toupee on hire purchase.
Yes.
Because if you defaulted on the payments, I mean, surely nobody would want it back.
Well, there is I hesitate to say poignant. It, again, he's got a real sense of drama. Obviously, he's a terrific plotter as a novelist, and he's got a great imagination. But what really, and his recall, of course, is fantastic in this. He talks about going to the Castle Market in Sheffield because his father has this certificate of authentication for this toupee. And he sends his son because he needs to get his toupee mended. He sends his son in to pretend that it's his uncle who needs his toupee mended. And he's clearly being kind of sold a kind of swizz, you know, but because of his vanity, he's fallen for all of this. And this is a kind of extraordinary chapter that unfolds where the kind of son colludes in the father's, perhaps his humiliation, he becomes himself humiliated.
I never heard of having to authenticate your toupee, but, you know, maybe that was the old days.
It's interesting, just thinking about, you know, he is, you're right, he's better known as a novelist. I think I've recently been reading Howard Jacobson's memoir, and of course, you know, a novelist, and you just, and also a memoir of a lot of it, of the North. And you just wonder, do you have to be a novelist to capture those moments, those particularly visual moments that bring in vanity and sadness and comedy and tragedy all at the same time? I shouldn't say that really, Catherine, because
I'm not
you're right, a memoir, you're not a novelist, and there are many, many great really put my foot in it now.
So the answer to that, Alex, is no, you don't have to be a novelist.
That's a very closed question. No is the answer. But I suppose what I'm saying, you know, there is a really interesting overlap, isn't there, often?
He does very much home in on beautiful, and some of the chapters are only a few pages long, but you really get this sense. So there's one chapter where Edric, at the age of about 12 or 13, takes up angling. He seems to apply himself to a hobby like this just as much as he applies himself to the paper route that he has to do, or working at Fine Fair supermarket later, or studying. He's quite single-minded about this, but also I think it's a way of asserting his own identity against the father. And he talks about the empty greenness of Lincolnshire, and it just perfectly describes, to me, Lincolnshire. Those kind of beautiful descriptive elements do run through. I suppose he has fashioned it thematically as well, because it stops very abruptly. It stops when he goes to university. And so you don't get that retrospective feel that, even though he is writing from a perspective clearly of middle age, you don't get that retrospective feel that he's slightly, it's very immediate, is what I'm trying to say. You don't feel that it's a kind of linear representation necessarily. I mean, he talks about power cuts as he's doing his A-levels, the power cuts and the 3-day week, but that really doesn't intrude very much on this sense of here is one street, which he doesn't mention this in the book, but I found out the street he grew up on was featured in The Full Monty, which lo and behold is returning to our screens.
Yes, yeah.
as we see the plucky steelworkers, ex-steelworkers deal with the North Sheffield 25 years later. So it's actually quite interesting how everything goes around, comes around.
I was going to talk about, you mentioned, you say the paradox of this industrial part rural city surrounded by the hills and gritstone edges of the Peak District. It is a paradox, isn't it, Sheffield? Because a lot of the talk about it was all about, you know, about industry and steel and pits and all of that. But it's surrounded by great, great beauty. And there's a very, I would say there's a very strong awareness of the beauty and the importance of bringing the nature back in.
That's right. And lots of Sheffielders often say that Sheffield is the only city in England to be partway into a national park. When I moved my family to Sheffield, I was very small. I was three. And so it was around the sort of the time that Edric was leaving. But we had a coal fire in our first house, and we had these giant crags at the end of the street, looked out over the Rivlin Valley. So there was always that sense that it's a very urban place. And like Edric, a lot of the architecture, is sort of still covered in soot then in the 70s. There was a blackened church in Bramall Lane in Sheffield, which wasn't cleaned till the 90s. And actually, I preferred the blackened church because that seemed quite symbolic of the city's industrial past. But then you do have these grit stones and these edges, and this Sheffield sort of sitting in the middle of it, really. And you can see that from any aspect of the city. So it is quite extraordinary. I'm sounding like a tourist guide, but
now I'm a big fan of Sheffield. It's especially the centre, it's gorgeous, I think. Now I used to go there in my youth. When it was fun, but it was less gorgeous. But now you come out of the train station, it's just it's fantastic.
Yeah, I would say that. I also say that Sheffield hasn't benefited from the generation that a lot of cities, northern cities like perhaps Manchester have or Liverpool. So it has been quite forgotten. I mean, the Heritage Lottery Fund has done amazing things to bring back some of that, that sort of 19th century, the amazing botanical gardens and the general cemetery and things like that. But I think just the city, it's suffered always from planning issues and development issues. For example, there's conservation areas, but opposite them you have yet more new buildings that going up. So it is, again, that's another paradox, if you like.
And so whereas Edric's book is very, you say it's very, very specific, almost limited in about time and place, the second book you talk about, which is No One Round Here Reads Tolstoy, Memoirs of a Working Class Reader by Mark Hodkinson, that's a bit less specific and focused, is that right?
Yes. So Mark Hodkinson is a really interesting guy. He grew up in Rochdale in Lancashire, about a decade after Edric, and possibly a similar kind of household, that with less of the posturing and violence, I think, that Edric, much less of that, that Edric had to endure. And, you know, it's a great title. It really sort of, he's really like laying his words on the table.
And,
no one around here reads Tolstoy, so why are you reading books? And you know, it's a house filled with television, and there was one book which was kept on top of the wardrobe along with his cycling proficiency certificate. So that was the status of books in the house. And he is a sort of self-confessed autodidact and collector, so he would collect anything, beer mats, football cards, and he started to read and collect books, and he was an avid reader. He didn't actually go to he went to secondary modern. He sort of details these school days with kind of humor and pathos as well. And then he's a really determined character. You really appreciate that from the book. He's very expansive, he's very enthusiastic, he's perhaps too expansive and enthusiastic. He went on to become a journalist, and he founded a publishing company, and he's done, you know, various things in sport. Has written quite a few books, sporting books as well. So this is a very personal memoir, but it really is about that not holding back. And also I think that you do get, I got very much caught up in that irrepressibility, even as I sort of, I thought, oh God, why are you talking about that again? And the quite sort of painfully self-conscious moments, and in the writing too, there was always another aspect that drew me back into it. And he has this figure of this grandfather, interspersed, this sort of memory of his grandfather interspersed throughout the book, this man who suffered from mental illness, but who he looked up to and was very close to. And that's this kind of ghostly figure in the tapestry of the book, as well as his later discussions on meeting some of these heroes of Northern writing, such as Alan Silitale and Hunter Davies, the Beatles biographer, and Barry Hines, who wrote A Kestrel for a Knave, which Hogginson writes about very well. That, again, that's, if you're writing about the North, you, no matter how characterised it is, you can't really get away from that book and the film that came out of it.
Yes, well, I do want to talk about that. But before, I did want to talk about the, just mention the caricature thing, because that's not Northern, is it? But, I mean, it's sort of partly about alienation, about being the only bookish one in a family not interested in books, but that doesn't mean, you know, I'm sure that as many people in the North reading Tolstoy as there were anywhere else, that's not a particularly Northern thing. That's just where he happened to be. Or do you get a sense that he's saying it is?
He's describing that world, which is quite recognisable if you are, you know, from that part of the world. And but I think he's perhaps slightly sending it up. I don't want to do him a disservice by saying that, but he's perhaps presenting an archetype and then slightly demolishing it. I think he's very aware of the caricaturizing of the North, and I think that as well, I think the slight issue I have with both these books is this, well, not necessarily these books, but the whole kind of, when you have a discussion or you have a conversation about the North, it's very homogenised. I'm sure you appreciate that, Lucy. You know, people don't distinguish between different towns and cities or counties. And of course, every place is, Sheffield, for example, is different from Manchester and Leeds as it is from Newcastle and Birmingham.
Totally, completely different. And it's just, like what's happening in Liverpool has got nothing necessarily to do with what's going on in Sheffield, as you say.
It's a catch-all phrase, but I think that, and of course he doesn't say a Northern working class reader, the subtitle is a working class reader. So I think that, I think that what he's talking about, particularly as the book goes on, is that, and I found this when I left Sheffield and went to university at the end of the 80s, away, far away from the city, that there's a world that is quite forgotten. So he talks about the 1980s and the social unrest. He mentions the miners' strike. It's real kind of Boys from the Black Stuff era, you know, the whole Alan Bleasdale television series with Gizzard Job. And when I went to, university, there were people who grew up in the home counties who didn't know what a recession was and had never heard of anything, didn't really understand recent history. To them, the 80s was all about opportunity, and it wasn't like that for Mark Hogginson. It wasn't like that for thousands of people. It was a real North-South divide, and perhaps it's never really gone away.
Is there also, I wonder, a sort of male-female design? You know, because as you say, it's not called, you know, Memoirs of a Northern Working Class Reader, and it's not called Memoirs of a Male Working Class Reader either. But thinking about, you know, the other books he's written about music, about football, there are areas that have been kind of the preserve of men writing about them, men supporting them, men get, you know, this idea of sort of the fandom and the interest, and you mentioned that he was a collector of things too. Do you think there's a kind of aspect of sort of gender, you know, performance of gender that's going on here, that it was almost worse that he was a reader because he was a young boy?
Oh, definitely. I think for him, and there's a interesting comic, almost comic but quite sad, exchange between him and his father, at one point when he's a teenager, and his father kind of sits him down and is basically, is there anything you want to tell us? I.e., are you gay because you're reading so much? Do you have a problem with girls? Now, it was that sort of incomprehension that he's quite candid about. And I think that was probably quite difficult for him growing up. I mentioned in the review about him needing glasses because he had poor eyesight, but his mother thinks he's showing off. He wants to look intellectual rather than the fact that he actually needs glasses to see. So I think there is that sense of, going back to the Edric as well, the father boasts about his son being a grammar school boy, but he basically keeps telling him, you think the world owes you a living. You know, your brain's coming from me. I could have done that. But he shows no interest in helping to elevate his son. He makes him, you know, work to pay for his uniform, but he capsizes everything that Edric tries to do for himself and is always reflected back on himself. So I think with Hodkinson, it's more a kind of ruefulness about those misunderstandings that occur between parents and children who are growing away from each other.
And you say that Hodkinson, he writes very well about A Kestrel for a Knave and Kes. This is a sort of wider sense of alienation, isn't it? And that the characters in that, and the boy and it's his bullying older brother, isn't it? And the companionship that he finds with the bird, he thinks that might kind of sum up his generation, that they've been left behind, neglected locally and nationally. And I get the feeling from the end of your piece that you think it's still very much in that position.
Well, I think looking more generally, and perhaps less specifically, well, no, specifically about the North. Again, I'm using that.
It's difficult, though. It's difficult not to.
It is, but I think we're looking, you know, it's a kind of era that we're living through at the moment without being especially political about it, but there are people who are struggling massively and have been over the last couple of years and longer. And with the access to education being very much bound up with market forces and with being able to afford it, then I think that they're getting back to an era of less opportunity. I don't particularly think the grammar schools and the whole set 11 plus system was a great idea. I mean, in my own family, one brother passed it and one brother didn't, you know, and you have your kind of determination that your future is determined by it. My father went to grammar school, but he grew up in a council house. So, but I think with the whole thing about the Billy Casper, who's the main character in A Kestrel for a Knave, and what's happening now is, yes, I think that we can kind of wring our hands about this situation. We can wring our hands about the depiction, but actually it's not as uncommon. And I think I'm not really sure the direction that we're going to go in terms of how people are going to be, I'm not even going to use that terrible term, levelling up, how people are going to be kind of protected and not left behind. And I think Hodkinson does this very well. He's not sentimental about it, but it really did strike me that this young man he went to school with, who was always an outsider and not even in a kind of iconoclastic way, he was just the kid that everybody laughed at, and there was more than one, and he ended up and taking his own life. So there are many more things in the book, but it's one aspect that really struck me.
Can I just sort of kind of more broadly, I suppose, this idea of the kind of literature and the memoir of place. I mean, this is an enormous body of material that you yourself are now joining. And I wondered the extent to which, you know, we're talking about the present day and the immediacy of some of the problems that we're being presented with now, and the future of those problems. How everything's going to pan out, but how do you think that's going to kind of affect memoir writing? That's a very big question, isn't it?
Yes, because where do you stop with memoir writing? I think that's the problem that Hodkinson
has.
He's kind of on a roll, and I think the problem with his memoir is he's almost trying to write a State of the Nation book within his own personal reminiscences. And I think he's got all this material and he wants to share it.
Do you think the title has that sort of slight implication of the, you know, all unhappy families unhappier in their own way sort of thing? You know, memoir has to be incredibly specific, doesn't it, to really grab a reader. Mm. Yes, you want to have the kind of universal things that even someone like me, a southerner, can understand. And you'll notice I've been keeping terribly quiet in this conversation, lest I'm outed as a really softy southerner. But you know, it does have to be specific. You know, you think of, for, you know, a great example of the genre, Why Be Happy When You Can Be Normal, with Jeanette Winterson. I mean, that had so many specifics to do with her mother, to do with her status as an adopted child, her mother as a religious fanatic, essentially. There's always got to be something that just makes it utterly personal to the writer, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I think with Edric, it's the father. With Hodkinson, it's really the reading. I mean, it's about how he he's amassed, you know, thousands and thousands of books, and the book actually starts with an epilogue where he's moving house, but he just doesn't know what to get rid of. And I think that's perhaps stands for the book in itself. You know, he's got so much there. He's got so many. He's in so possession of so much that he can't quite edit it, really.
You're saying you would have recommended a more sort of, you know, knowing what to get rid of sort of approach to shifting books, as it were.
Yes, although I suffer from that myself. But
don't we all?
I know it's a problem. What did you say earlier, Alex? The teetering stack. Stack problem.
Put me in mind of someone, and I'm going to do a million times the kind of don't try this at home. But I knew someone once who amassed so many books that they gave up cooking so they could put them in their oven, which just to me sounds like health and safety nightmare red flag, because you'd be so frightened you'd forget and go to make some toast or something, and then it'd be a conflagration. But I did think, on the other hand, it spoke of a great commitment
to books rather than food. Yeah,
yes, just eat sandwiches and keep your books in the baby belling. That's
okay. Please nobody do that.
We cannot on our librarians' wages, we cannot afford the lawsuit.
No, absolutely not. Catherine, I'm sure you don't keep your books in the oven, but you keep them somewhere sensible, and we're going to look forward to yours, which is published next year, is that right?
That's right. It's coming out next spring, and it's called The Stirrings, which is very Sheffield specific, but also quite ambiguous.
Brilliant. But we'll look forward to it, and many thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Lucy. Thanks, Alex.
Is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Emma Cleary and Catherine Taylor.
And thank you to you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.